Hello, welcome to your meditation practice as part of the Open Heart Project. My name is Susan Piver. I'm very happy to sit with you in meditation. We're going to sit together today for 10 minutes and we're going to start very soon, so please get seated. I don't know if you can hear the rain, but the sky has just opened up here and it's pouring rain, so I hope if you can hear it that you like the sound of rain because it's coming down quite heavily here in New England. So please take your seat, whether you're on a cushion on the floor with your legs crossed loosely in front of you, like me, or in a chair. And if you do sit in a chair, please sit with your feet flat on the floor and remember that sitting in a chair is equally as spiritual as sitting on the floor. So as we get settled, I want to raise a difficult topic, actually, but it is very relevant and topical and unfortunate. And I've heard from a lot of you with this particular question. So here it is. When it comes to spiritual teachers and practices, how do I know who to trust? Because a lot of people are proving themselves to be untrustworthy. And if I find myself in such a situation where I've gotten beneficial teachings, I've learned a lot, but then I find out that the teacher or teachers are not trustworthy, does that invalidate the teachings? So if this is not of interest to you, cool. Just skip forward to the meditation. The time marker is in this email or on this post. It says exactly where the meditation starts. But if you are interested, I want to try to offer something helpful. How do I know who to trust in the world of spirituality? And one of the reasons I'm hearing this question so often is that I share it with you. I have this question too, because in my own lineage, Shambhala Buddhist lineage, which I've been practicing in now for close to 25 years, it has been alleged slash revealed that there has been clergy sexual misconduct on the part of Sakyong Mipa, the lineage holder of Shambhala, the person who I had thought of as my teacher, who I now have to question all of that. And so, but Shambhala is not by any means the only spiritual tradition that has had these issues. That doesn't make it any better, of course. But it's natural to think, who am I supposed to trust here? So the first thing I want to say is, if anyone tells you this is how you know who to trust, or this is who you should trust, that's untrustworthy. Immediately, that's completely clear, black and white, ixnay. No one can tell you who to trust, and no one can tell you how to know what is trustworthy, because we each have to figure it out for ourselves, which is scary. And at one time or another in our lives, we're going to be in for some disappointment. So hopefully there'll be small disappointments, not egregious, like the ones being described in Shambhala and elsewhere. So here's what I say. I say, don't let me tell you who to trust and how to know if you should trust. You have to trust yourself. You have to use your own intelligence, your own intuition, your own instincts. These are the real teacher. The only thing I can say that I know quite clearly is there is only one person you need to trust, and that's yourself. So the first thing for me, and this is in no way meant to bypass the suffering of the victims or to excuse in any way the behavior of Sakyong Mipam or anyone who has taken advantage of others from a power position, sexually or otherwise. Nonetheless, for me, the teachings remain powerful. When I look at my life as a practitioner now for more than 20 years, almost 25 years, I see that I have applied so many of the things that I've learned from Chögyam Trungpa, in particular, Sakyong Mipham, Tulku Tundub Rinpoche, Tralag Rinpoche, other teachers, Pema Chodron, and I have corroborated what they have said to me in their books or in their classes or to me personally by testing it in my own life. Is this really how you become more patient? Does this really lead to more compassion? Is this truly a way to become gentler toward myself and others? Does this actually make me more confident? And so my answers to those questions are yes. Because the person who told it to me may turn out to be a dick, let's say, for lack of a better word, or confused, or cruel, whatever word you want to use, does that mean that my experiments with the teachings are now invalidated? My choice is no, but you have to choose for yourself. I feel comfortable separating the teachings from the teacher. Teachers are always going to be imperfect. I give you Exhibit A. Teachings, however, can actually be perfect. And I'll tell you another thing that sort of gives me confidence in this notion. I'm a writer, I've written books, and I try to do the best job I can, like anyone would. But I read what I have written. I know how puny I am. I know that I screw things up and that I have good qualities and bad qualities and that sometimes I can do the things that I think are right and sometimes I screw it up. But when I read what I've written, often my first reaction is, who said that? I didn't know. I knew that. I discovered it in the act of writing. And so there's something about the writing that is different than the teacher, the writer. Just like I used to work in the music business. If you go hear amazing songs by sensitive songwriters or powerful players and you think, oh my God, that person, I can just hear their depth, their soulfulness, their passion. And then you meet them and they're, you know, just a regular person. That's another way of saying, well, the thing that is offered is not always exactly the same or a perfect reflection of the person who's offering it. My opinion. The rain's getting crazy out there. So my suggestion to you and to everyone else I've spoken to is do what you can to protect your relationship to the teachings, not the teacher. Do what you need to do, what you can to protect your connection to your own wisdom, because that's really what the teachings that resonate with you are. So that means going to battle and taking an activist approach to, you know, dispelling any form of sexual clergy misconduct. Please do that. Please do that. If that protects your relationship to the teachings or otherwise, because it's just a good thing to do. If what will protect your relationship to the teachings is to take efforts and take actions, because everybody's got to take actions right now in our world. Everybody, nobody's excluded, no hiding. I'm going to do some of that. And I'm going to also take time to contemplate the teachings, to disconnect from the world so that I can recover my sense of balance. And then I'm going to go back in. Then do that. If you feel like engaging tears me apart to a point or triggers me because I have had this kind of abuse in the past, I say do whatever you can and whatever you need to protect yourself. It's not chickening out. So first two things, don't trust anyone who tells you who to trust. Second, do what you can to protect your relationship to the teachings. And third, I look at the students of a teacher that I admire, because that is actually the most accurate living reflection of the teacher that we can find. So the students I know of Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche in particular, about whom there are many controversies and problems and stories, those who were close students of his, who I know, therefore they remained in the lineage, so the ones who hated it left, I don't know them, they're like the smartest people I ever met. And beyond smart, soulful and nuanced and discerning and kind and funny, they're like some of the best people I've ever met in my life. So I take that as some kind of indication of their training. So I hope that's useful. It's a big question. It's an open question. A friend of mine calls this an active learning situation, meaning we don't know where it's going to end. So I'm here. I'm here with you, asking the same questions, and I'll continue to try to offer something that I think is useful. So if this was useful, yay. If not, I'll try again. Okay, let's practice. So to begin your practice, sit up straight. And let there be a sense of dignity and ease in your upper body. And let there be a sense of rootedness and heaviness and solidness in your lower body. Boom, I'm right here. And I'm also aspiring up. And I can feel that in my body. The hands rest on the legs, palms down. And the hands can just rest. Let the front body relax. Let the shoulders relax. The mouth is closed, but the lips and teeth are slightly parted. The breath is natural, in and out through the nose. And the eyes are open, because this is a practice of wakefulness. And being awake really helps when we're trying to figure out who to trust. In any case, the eyes are open and the gaze is cast down to a distance that feels comfortable to you, up to 6 feet, depending on how far your screen is. And the eyes are soft. And rather than staring at your chosen point, imagine that you could gaze into the middle distance, if that makes sense, and see what that feels like. Let the brow relax. And the crown of the head reaches up a little bit. Feel yourself breathing. Feel the inhale. Feel the exhale. This is different than noticing the breath. We're actually just feeling it. Feel the inhale, feel the exhale. Your mind will continue to make thoughts. Absolutely fine. Most of them will just come and go. You don't have to do anything about those thoughts. Just let that happen. But if at any point you notice you're absorbed in thought, completely, like you've forgotten about your breath. Then you want to step in, as it were, say to yourself silently, thinking, like to differentiate between thinking and meditating. Let go of your thoughts. Whatever they are is fine. Letting go with a gentle touch, coming back with a gentle touch, and taking a fresh start, feeling the breath. Thank you so much for your practice. Thank you for practicing with me. And thank you for practicing together.